Well, in the introduction last time, I warned you that we were getting into one of the darker and grimmer books of the Bible as a whole, and the Old Testament in particular. I gave you the example, in fact, of on an exchange on 60 Minutes. The topic was censorship, and when the 60 Minutes commentator wanted to confront a Baptist minister about things like censorship, what does he do? He picks a passage from the end of Judges where this woman is gang raped, you know, and says, you know, where do you guys get off talking about censorship when you have this kind of thing in your sacred, you know, in your sacred book? Okay, so it is true. This is, there are dark moments in Kings, of course, in 1 Kings, 2 Kings, and dark moments in Samuel, but it's a pretty unrelentingly dark book. It at the very beginning, the very first image you're given almost is this king Adonai Bezek, who is captured and mutilated, and you're told that he has been mutilating people. You know, he captures these kings, he cuts off their thumbs and their big toes, right? Because you can't grab a sword, you can't fight, you can't run away. And then they live as beggars, kind of in his household. They're kind of living as from scraps from the table. That's his way of humiliating them. By the way, in I think it's 2 Kings, after is it Jehoiakim, one of the kings who rebels against the Babylonian, I think it's Nebuchadnezzar at that point. He's not only captured, but they kill his children in front of him and then put his eyes out. So that's the last thing he ever saw, was the slaughter of his children. And then he lives as like a beggar in the royal palace, you know, year after year after year after year. Okay? So you're given this figure who's been mutilating people he captures. Now he's conquered, and of course, what do they do to him? They mutilate him. And he has his thumbs cut off and his big toes cut off. And you're given his sort of remorse, not a genuine moral remorse, I'm a bad guy, but the remorse that, you know, I've ended up in the same way, that I've had the same thing done to me that I was doing to others. If you read Thucydides' Peloponnesian Wars, remember this is these famous wars between Athens and Sparta. By the middle of the book, the Athenians, remember, they're the ones who are kind of democratic as opposed to the Spartans, who are kind of oligarchs and aristocrats. But the Athenians have used some very rough tactics on their allies to get them to cooperate against Sparta. And at one point, they have this island, Melos, that they've told them, you know, you've always been a Spartan ally, but unless you side with us, we're going to slaughter you down to the last man. And the Melians try to negotiate and try to find a way around it and appeal to justice and appeal to the gods, and the Athenians will have none of it. And they end up conquering Melos and slaughtering the island. And Thucydides doesn't get you to the end of the Peloponnesian War. He dies before it's finished. But Xenophon, who was a student of Socrates, he picks it up. And about, I think it's the second chapter of his version, he talks about how the Athenian navy is defeated. Right now would be off the coast of Turkey, what would be modern-day Istanbul, right? And they realize they're done for. And once the news gets to Athens, you're told that there's this groan, this collective groan that starts at the Piraeus, the port, goes all the way up the long walls to the city. For now, the Athenians knew that what they had done to the Melians and to the Mytileneans and all these other people on these islands would now be done to them. Okay? So Adonai Bezek is having, you know, that moment. You know, so you don't know if it's a real moral remorse, but it's a certainly, you know, I did this and now it's being done to me. Robert Alter, who I've mentioned as the author of this book, Ancient Israel, and has some very helpful commentary. He takes this image at the beginning, and this is what he says about it. It should be observed that this grisly detail is an apt thematic and imagistic introduction to Judges, the most violent of all the books in the Bible. In the stories that follow, swords will be thrust into bodies, tent pegs into heads. People will be variously mashed and crushed. Toward the end of the book, the dismembered parts of a murdered woman's body will be sent out to the sundry tribes in order to incite a civil war. The mutilation of the king then introduces us into a realm of political instability in which both people and groups are violently torn asunder. Okay? So it's not accidental that the book starts with this. It starts with this image to kind of set a tone for you, to let you know this is what it's going to look like. And in particular, notice that the fastens on that dismemberment, because that's what's going to happen. The people in various ways are going to come apart. You know, they are meant to be a united people under God. They have been given this gift of the land. They are meant to make that land one under the Lord's sovereignty. And you are told in various ways through the book that each man did what was right in his own eyes, right? Which is a guaranteed way for things to scatter and fall apart. Okay, so think about in Genesis, right? The Tower of Babel. They want to build a height so that they can be like God or be remembered like God, have their greatness remembered on the earth. And what does God do? He gives them these different languages and confuses them. And when St. Augustine comments on that, right, he talks about how it is that pride of its very nature disperses people and scatters them. Right? You cannot work together in harmony unless there is some degree of humility and goodwill. And to the degree to which it's all about your own sense of your own excellence, right? Your own power, your own significance, right? People fall apart. They can't work together. Okay. The term Adonai Bezek means Lord of Lightning. And you know why he earned that name? I mean, it's kind of a flattering name for a warrior leader. You know, like the way that, you know, in the 70s when you had a sports car, you're going to put like lightning bolts on the side of it, you know? I mean, that probably has a resonance through the ages. Church fathers, some of these early patristic commentators, they'll see this resonance with the way that Luke will describe the fall of Satan, that Satan fell like lightning. Right? Satan fell like lightning. And so they will see Adonai Bezek as a kind of image of the devil, but now the devil as defeated by Christ. That just as the devil took people into captivity, that he maimed them spiritually and morally, that they were, as it were, helpless in sin, that Christ's defeat of the devil, right, now liberates the captives, and that the devil in turn is, if you like, maimed or held captive. In other words, that his power is shrunk, restricted, that his pride is humiliated. Okay? They see him as a figure for that in light of this title, the Lord of Lightning. Okay. What I have here, this is the work of Lillian Klein, her Triumph of Irony in the Book of Judges. He talks about how it is that in this first chapter, you basically get a list of the tribes and then the various ways in which they're related to the land. And you're introduced first to tribes they're doing the job. they conquer. There's some among, a little amount with the Kenites of living among. The Kenites live on fairly restricted terms, as I recall. But then conquered, destroyed. But then as you get beyond these first tribes, you get this pattern of failed to conquer, lived among. Failed to conquer, lived among. Failed to conquer, lived among. It becomes a kind of a leitmotif to the point that you get to the Danites who are in some way in some kind of forced labor. They're not able to. In fact, they're actually pushed out. The Danites actually have to flee the area where they are, okay, or what they were supposed to inherit. And in fact, if you think about the narrative, the contrast between 1 and 2, you had the oddity, did you not? At the beginning of 1, you're told of Joshua's death, and then there's all this narration of these various tribes failing to live up to what Joshua had done. And then in chapter 2, it's like Joshua's alive again. And they're talking about his conquest. This is one of the things that you have to pay attention to the narrative flow and not give in to the temptation to think that, this is just the editor napping, right? It's just maybe they had different stories or they got switched, you know, they got mixed up. Already you know that this is not being given in a historical order, right? The business with the Benjamites and the civil war that happens at the end, that actually happens historically before these other things. So the author is already inverting the historical order. One of the things that is probably behind that is the point that, both Klein and Alter and several people will make, that there's a kind of thematic order that's being pursued here. There's, in other words, certain points the author wants to make that are not historical points. If you recall Klein, I had a list last week which showed you that basically the history in Judges is being given an order of the tribes. From those tribes which seem to have been the most faithful, so Judah and Benjamin are up at the top, all the way down to the Danites who end up getting erased as God's people. For example, in the list in the Apocalypse, the tribe of Dan isn't even named. They become a kind of byword for idolatry. Danite and idolater tend to be almost synonymous. So there's a different order than a historical order. And some see in this in chapter 2 that what the author is doing there is showing you the contrast between what it is the Hebrew people were supposed to do and through Joshua and what actually happens. I want to emphasize again the thing that I started with in that little clip from Kabiria, that in dwelling among these pagan peoples, that they adopt their ways. Okay, they can't live in this sort of modus vivendi of mutual sharing and mutual faith enrichment and exchange and dialogue, all those kind of modern things that we like where people have very, very different religious beliefs. These are people who are living a way of life which is not just immoral, but on some level demonic. And the chosen people are not that far away from it. You know, they have, of course, from God, through miracles and grace, this sort of gravitational pull away from that. But it's, as we see in this narrative, it's not a gravitational pull that's impressively strong. One of the moments in this book that's a favorite moment of mine is Gideon. We'll talk about this. Gideon gets this vision from God, and he asks God, "Why aren't you with us like you were in the old days?" And God tells him, "I will be with you. You know, things will change. We're going to push out the bad guys and so on." And one of the little requests that God makes is, "You know how your father has this big statue to Baal in the front yard? Could you knock that down for me?" Okay? Now, think about the, if you like, devotional religious cluelessness of Gideon's inquiry to God. I understand. Well, you know, you can just see it if this were filmed. You know, here he is talking to God, and why aren't you with us like the old days? And like in the fort, you know, in the background, there's that big old honking statue of Baal as he's asking him this. So these are people who God is trying to bring into an understanding of who he is, of who the true God is, how the right way of life is. But this is something that for the Hebrew people at this stage in their development is really, really hard. They are still, for all practical purposes, a pagan people. For all practical purposes, they're still a pagan people with these glimmers and, you know, kind of counterexamples of devotion, of people who get it. So as we go into the second chapter, you get this expression. You're introduced to these places that become proverbial later in the Hebrew tradition. from Gilgal. Sometimes you'll see it as Galgal, from Gilgal to Bashan. Okay? Remember, Gilgal was where the Hebrew people, before they were going to attack Jericho, they had not been circumcised. They had not been carrying out circumcision in the desert. So right in the sight of the enemy city, all the men get circumcised. They trust in God's power that they go through this necessary ritual and that they will be able to overcome. And in fact, the Hebrew word here is, it talks about an overturning or a changing, like the stone being rolled away. Like the weight of their kind of disgrace or disobedience is somehow being removed now in this new ritual. So this was a place that was significant of renewing once more the covenant between the chosen people and God. But now it's given to you in the second chapter by way of contrast. You're meant to look at it in terms of, you know, what was happening under Joshua and where the Hebrew people were and where they're at now. Okay? From Gilgal to Bashan, because Bashan, now they describe the place as weeping. This is the place where we wept, right? An angel appears to them and basically reads them the riot act for how disobedient they're being. You're not being faithful. You're not conquering the lands that God has given you. You're not receiving this gift. You're not following his ways. You're worshiping other gods. And what do? They all cry. And the problem is that it's emotional. They have a kind of emotional remorse, but they don't have a real remorse that translates into action. When you read the Screwtape letters, one of the points that Lewis makes over and over again in various ways is that emotion in religious life is something that people can sometimes think of as almost constitutive of religious life, right? That I have these emotions about God, or I have these emotions about the soul. I have emotions when I read the Bible, the church, or so on. And the point that he makes in various ways is, you know, emotion, like everywhere else in life, is not enough. You know, your faith life has to transcend whatever your emotions are about it. Okay? If you were to only go to church or only to pray when you felt like it, I mean, that's the beginning of the end. What will happen is you'll do it less and less and feel like it less and less as time goes on. The thing that allows the feelings to be there is that there's this act of the will and there's act of the intelligence. In other words, that you decide, this is what I'm going to do. And then eventually your feelings will get in line. But of course, your feelings will still be doing this up and down thing. You know, I think of somebody like Dorothy Day, who had this beautiful faith life, daily mass, daily rosary. But she would talk about there were days when she would pray that each of her rosary beads felt as big as a bowling ball. Okay, that, you know, she just didn't feel like it. Or someone like Mother Teresa of Calcutta, now Saint Teresa, who would talk about, you know, feelings of abandonment by God. Well, you would think if anybody would feel like God were just kind of on the, like on the speed dial, you know, it would be her. But yet, she talks about these feelings of abandonment. Think about our Lord on the cross. Even our Lord, who is truly God and truly man, he allowed in his acceptance or his union with human nature, there was a point on the cross where essentially he took his divinity and did not allow it to overflow into his human emotions. Okay? Then when he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Right? That's real. That's not just, well, I'm imitating a feeling of loss here, you know, for all of you people who have genuine loss. No. By an act of the will, he is not letting that joy of the Beatitude go into his human emotions so that he truly feels, not by figment, not by play acting, not just give you something to, you know, to model yourselves after, by a real feeling of abandonment. He allows himself a real feeling of abandonment on the cross. Okay? So feelings are not enough. There can be sins that we weep over, But it doesn't matter if we weep if we just go right back to them. Their remorse has to translate into some kind of act. So remember when I was in college and I would have my Irish confessor that I would go to over the summer at St. Apollinaris Parish, Father Kavanaugh. And he would talk to me about occasions of sin. It's not enough to avoid the sin, Arthur. There's also the occasions of sin, right? And that's a very important point. Are you setting yourself up to sin? At the point where you're sinning over and over again, but the very things that put you in the situation where you're likely to make that choice, that you're not avoiding them, then you'll never change. It'll never be any different. Okay? So what the problem is, maybe you read that, you know, you read those tears and you sort of feel bad for them, you know, they have some understanding they're doing the wrong thing. But the reason God's unimpressed is because it's not translating into anything. It's not translating into action. It's not enough to feel bad. You have to make choices. My wife will, you know, when the children say they're sorry. I mean, my wife appreciates that they've said they're sorry, but she always, you know, what are you going to do? What are you going to do so that you're not sorry again? You know, damage has been done. I don't just want your expression of remorse. What's your plan? What's your plan that this isn't going to happen again? Okay. And from there, then you're introduced to how it is that the effect of living among these various among these various peoples, the various Canaanite tribes who are living among, they start to worship Baal. Later on, Ashtoreth is named. Okay? And these are both fertility deities. These are both Canaanite fertility deities. And, you know, I mentioned already temple prostitution. That's the thing that Ashtoreth is associated with. I have a little text here from Herodotus. Herodotus wrote a history, probably it's just called the histories. The part that everybody remembers that's famous is the Persian Wars. So the Battle of Marathon, the Battle of Salamis, and so on, when the Xerxes, and so on, when they invaded Greece. He's the one who writes that history. But in the early books of the histories, he has a book on Egypt, he has a book on Babylonia. He's writing about these other cultures around the Greeks. And in fact, he's one of the people who provides one of the earliest examples of what you might call cultural relativism, where he'll look at these other cultures and say, well, you know, it's different from our culture, but it seems to work for them. So, you know, people have the idea that before the modern age, everybody was just judgmental about everybody else's culture. Nope, read Herodotus. He sees that there are these other cultures that are different from the Greeks and that, you know, these various customs they have seem to allow them to live together, and it's different from ours, but let them be. Now, periodically, there are customs that'll just say, yuck, and this is one of them. So this is from Herodotus' histories. The foulest Babylonian custom, oh, that's judgmental, is that which compels every woman of the land to sit in the temple of Aphrodite and to have intercourse with some stranger at least once in her life. Many women who are rich and proud and disdain to mingle with the rest drive to the temple in covered carriages, driven by teams, and they stand there with a great retinue of attendants. But most sit down in the sacred plot of Aphrodite with crowns of cord on their heads. There's a great multitude of women coming and going. Passages marked by line run every way through the crowd, by which men pass and make their choice. Once a woman has taken her place there, she does not go away to her home before some stranger has cast money into her lap and had intercourse with her outside the temple. But while he casts the money, he must say, I invite you in the name of Miletus. It doesn't matter what the sum of money is, the woman will never refuse, for that would be a sin, money being by this act made sacred. So she follows the first man who casts it and rejects no one. After their intercourse, having discharged her sacred duty to the goddess, she goes away to her home. And thereafter, there is no bribe so great that will get her. No kidding. So then the women that are fair and tall are soon free to depart and the uncomely have long to wait, but they cannot fulfill the law. For some remain there 3 years or four. There's a custom like this in some parts of Cyprus. Okay? So that's what temple prostitution looks like. It isn't necessarily a class of women. It could be required of all women. Okay? So if you needed additional reasons to abhor Canaanite culture, I hope I've provided one. I'm using the language of Herodotus, so Aphrodite, but the equivalent of Aphrodite in the Phoenician world would be Ashtoreth. There's always going to be in a pagan society or pagan religion, some kind of female goddess of love, fertility, and usually it's not going to be sort of romantic love. It could be romantic love, but certainly sexual. It's going to be that physical element, and that's Ashtoreth. One of the things commentators, St. Augustine, for example, will talk about judges. I mean, maybe when you look at this, you recognize that, gosh, you know, this is something that is a source of temptation for the chosen people. Isn't there some other scenario? Isn't there some other kind of setup where the people wouldn't be tempted in this way? But, you know, the patristic commentators will say, no, this is part of God's design. This is part of God's design. Those people are, these various pagan peoples are there to be, if you like, a source of temptation, which they are supposed to conquer. And they have the sufficient grace to conquer. They have the sufficient gifts to conquer. Remember, that's the message of Joshua. Go down. You have what you need. God will be with you. And they won't do it. And in a way, Judges is an important image of, you know, not just something from the Old Testament, but really something from the Christian life. Over the weekend, I was teaching in a diaconate program, and one of the things we were looking at is different dogmas of the church and kind of the traditions out of which those dogmas emerge. And we were talking about angels, talking about guardian angels. We talked about the belief in temptation from the devil. And some of the people in the group, they said, you know, I just find it hard to accept that God would allow there to be some kind of personal evil angel. So, you know, like the cartoon image, if you like. You have your guardian angel, and there's an angel on the other side that, you know, is giving you all these bad suggestions. And one of the things I said to that is, well, first, let's be clear. There isn't some official church teaching that you have, as it were, a personal devil assigned to you. Okay, that's not a dogma or defined teaching of the church. On the other hand, that is something that, while it is not New Testament, you can find Christian writers writing about there being an angel and a devil on the other side. You can find that as early as 110, 120 A.D. In other words, this is just the generation after the closing of the canon of the New Testament. So even if you want to say that it's not a dogma, this is something that is around almost from the beginning. This is the generation right after the closing of the canon of the New Testament. And the second thing you'd have to say is that, remember, you already, if you're accepting the Gospels and you're accepting the epistles, you're already buying into the view that you are the object of diabolic attack. You're already buying into that. Jesus himself in Matthew 4 is the object of diabolic attack in the desert. St. Peter tells you that the devil goes about as a lion, roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. You know, St. Paul in Ephesians tells you that our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the spirit of wickedness in high places. You know, in the Gospel of John, it's our Lord himself who calls the devil the prince of this world. And he calls him that three different times in the Gospel of John. Okay? Remember, it's also in John that our Lord tells Peter, Satan has desired to sift you like wheat, but I have prayed for you that you will be strengthened, and in turn you will strengthen the brethren. Okay? So I'm not sure that adding now the element that the devil would send a particular spirit. I don't know that that adds something essentially different to the idea that you are under diabolic temptation. I don't know that adds something essentially different. Go ahead, Kim.
In Hebrew, we have a Yetzer Hara and a Yetzer Tov, a good inclination and an evil inclination, and the two work together on your soul. And in Yom Kippur, we pray that the good inclination would be how you would want to orientate your life.
You know, and if it were just good inclination or bad inclination, I don't think people mind that. They don't mind inclinations. They don't like there being an actual being out there. You know, that's spooky. But again, you're already told throughout the New Testament that the devil targets human beings. And so that he assigns particular spirits to do this, again... But I think the reason that frightens us, yes, it is a scary thought on its own, but I think part of the reason it frightens us is because we just no longer pray for divine help in that. We don't cultivate angel of God, you know, the angel of God prayer. We don't cultivate the St. Michael prayer. We don't cultivate, in other words, this rich devotional life in which you're praying to the angels for assistance, that you're praying to God for assistance. We tend to de-emphasize spiritual warfare altogether. We tell confirmandi that being confirmed is all about, you know, accepting the faith as an adult, which I always feel, I hear that and I say, congratulations, you're a Lutheran. You know, that's Lutheran confirmation. You know, Catholic confirmation is that you are being enrolled as a soldier of Christ. That's what's essential to that sacrament. That's why in the old rite, if you're older, you know, when the bishop confirmed you, he gave you a little slap. He gave you a little slap because he was letting you know you are a soldier. You know, which some bishops still do that, but it tends to be, you know, dropped. So, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just kind of reflecting on the Our Father, the Lord's Prayer. I have a friend that got very hung up on lead us not into temptation.
Yeah.
He was 92 when he passed away, but he was French. So he used to use, he used to use the French translation was let us not succumb to the temptation, because he didn't want to think that God would lead us into temptation. But now that you're pointing this out, it makes sense that it could be just that tie into the Old Testament that it's translated.
Well, I mean, you're told that the Spirit led Jesus to the desert, and surely the Spirit knows that the devil is going to tempt him. That God does allow temptations. But the thing that you're told in St. Paul is not that God will never lead you to temptation. The thing that God tells you in St. Paul is that you will never be tempted above your ability. That you'll never be tempted. And that's what the chosen people are being told here. You have the ability to conquer these people. And what you're seeing over and over again is their unwillingness. Okay? So that's, you know, in this discussion that I had over the weekend in this class, I think what some people heard is they especially if you're a parent, you know, you have a tough enough time keeping your kids on the straight and narrow, and you just don't like to hear that there are these other things out there that are sort of out to get them. You know, come on, I worry enough about them as it is. God should be like removing all the problems. He should be helping me remove problems, not allowing there to be more problems. But at the same time, you have to say, look, especially, you know, when you send kids off into the world, when they're no longer in your home, and now they're out going to college, or they're out in their professional work, or they're out making a life of their own, or they're getting married, they're having families of their own, at a certain point, you know, all of those things involve risk. They all involve risk. And, you know, the only way there would be no risk at all is if you just kept them in your basement. You know, your mother and I have prayed about it, and we've thought that we're going to enroll you in this online college program, and you can just live in the mother-in-law suite downstairs. And if you want to party a little bit, we'll bring down a beer every once in a while. But please, we just feel as though you'd be better off in those circumstances. If they're going to grow up in ways that really allow them to take care of themselves and govern themselves and so on, that all involves risk. And the, you know, there. Look, and I'm not denying that there may be all sorts of ways in which you protect your children, and rightly so. But bit by bit, step by step, you really have to allow for greater risks so they can govern themselves, so they can rule themselves, so they can rule their own lives. And for the chosen people, God allows temptations because there are certain virtues that are brought out under those circumstances. How do you develop bravery if there is no danger? How do you develop patience if there is no suffering? How do you develop good judgment unless there aren't before you hard things to judge? Okay? There are all these virtues that are developed precisely where there is risk and danger and deprivation. And I have to say that on the one hand, yes, we do love our children, but there really can be this desire just not to see them suffer. And that's understandable as a parent, I feel, as much as any of you. But that's not always good. There are things that children, as children or as adults, there are things that they really do have to suffer. And as an adult, that's very hard for you to watch. As a parent, that's very hard for you to watch. But it's something that's necessary for, maybe necessary for them and for their long-term good. You want to protect them from all suffering whatsoever, but that isn't necessarily good for them. It may be less painful for you, but it's not good for them. Yeah, go ahead, Ms. Sarah. Oh, yeah, go ahead, please.
I was just going to mention all the way back to the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
You know, when God put everything so perfect except for that one tree.
Yes.
It's so interesting.
And of course, you always have people, you always have students. Well, you shouldn't have had that tree there at all. Again, what is the point of making creatures who are free if they are not able to use that freedom? Right? We, in fact, sometimes I'll have arguments with kind of atheist or skeptical folks that their view of God really is, I mean, if you were to translate their view of God into a parent, it would be the you are homeschooling in the basement. They think a loving God, that love means you protect people from all harm whatsoever. And so if there's any exposure to harm or risk, well, then God isn't truly good. And I said, you couldn't even make that work with teaching a kid with a bicycle. You know, is a good parent means that, you know, when they're five and they're trying out the bicycle, you just coat them bubble wrap? You know, is that what good parenting is? I mean, you can't translate that into anything in your own experience that you would think of as good parenting. If you had the kind of parent that you wanted God to be, you'd be completely smothered, you know? And usually they don't have a good response for that because it's true. A good God wills that his creatures work in the way that they work, you know? So he doesn't expect, you know, cheetahs on the Serengeti to adopt a vegetarian lifestyle. I mean, he's made them to kill Thompson's gazelles. That's how they're made. It's not bad for them to eat Thompson's gazelles. Okay, we are not run by instinct. We're just chemicals or whatnot. We have souls that allow us to know and allow us to choose. So, and the reason you make beings like that is they are going to be able to now know God and love God. But of course, part of the risk that's involved in making creatures like that is you can have creatures that are able to choose, not choose God. Right? They're not going to be able to really love or be happy or any of these, you know, these higher goods that we recognize as good. That's not going to happen unless they have minds and wills and hearts and all those things. But of course, to have a mind, to have a will, allows you to say, yes, this may be the right thing, but I'm not going to do it. I won't. I will not serve. You know, that's the thing it allows. Okay, I talked a little bit about this, but maybe I could say more about that later. Next week, I will send to Mrs. Cummins the, because we're doing two lessons, I'll send, yeah, the study questions and discussion questions, so she can get that out to the leaders so you'll know what to focus on. And so the chapters are...